This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to the Hindu Studies channel of the New Books Network. I am your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. You can find out about my background at rajbalkaran.com/academia. But more importantly, I have the pleasure of speaking with Pat Niebuhrchen, assistant professor at the Department of Religious Studies at the College of William and Mary. So we'll be speaking today about Patton's book, A Genealogy of Devotion, Bhakti, Tantra, Yoga, and Sufism in North India. Maybe our first question, Patton, is how did this book come about?
Well, this book is a sort of expansion and revision of my PhD dissertation. So when you talk about that, I could, you know, take you all the way back to my beginnings in undergrad with religious studies and getting interested in Hindu traditions. And there's a story that begins there. But sort of more recently, I started my graduate training at Indiana University, and I was very interested in this topic of Tantra. And then when I went to Columbia for my PhD, my PhD advisor, John Stratton Hawley, Jack Hawley, was, you know, one of the preeminent scholars of bhakti or Hindu devotion in the world, really. And through taking classes with him, I got more and more interested in bhakti and wanted to also keep up my interest in Tantra, and so started looking at the way that bhakti poets talk about tantric yogis and the ways that tantra and yoga inform the kind of bhakti that I was learning about. Meanwhile, I'm gaining in my PhD program language training, and I was doing some language immersion programs in India that were based in Jaipur. And just outside of Jaipur is a religious community, old religious community known as Galta, ended up becoming a major research site for me. So while in Jaipur learning Hindi, I spent a lot of time talking to people at Galta, this beautiful, it's in a gorge just outside of Jaipur, it goes back to the early 1500s, probably at least. And so I had that sort of physical site in India that I was connecting to bhakti poetry that I was reading in classes and there in India, and just starting to ask different questions about bhakti in a big picture. How does the scholarly community conceive of this Hindu devotion that is connected to the term bhakti? And many people would say this is the sort of mainstream religiosity of India today, or of Hinduism today. Many would probably say that it's bhakti. So how did it become so powerful? and particularly in North India, I felt like that the narrative explaining the rise of this Hindu devotion hadn't really been told. So I wanted to tell that story of how and why bhakti rises up in this particular period, which ends up being the early modern period, the Mughal period in North India, and how that rise was connected to, maybe had negative effects on other kind of forms of religiosity that had been previously dominant in Indian history. And so there was a sort of question looking forward, how did these things develop? And a question kind of looking back, a kind of genealogical question of how did bhakti become, get to where it is today? And also how did tantra come to be kind of perceived in India, largely along the lines of kind of disreputable black magic or kind of mumbo jumbo hocus pocus, which is, of course, different than how it's often, the word tantra is often perceived here in the United States and in North America.
So maybe it's clear that your book is about, your book being called A Genealogy of Devotion, it's tracing Indian devotionalism from the medieval period to present. Prior to diving into the heart of your argument, why don't you present for our audience what you mean by the term tantra here, especially as it may be different from how it's used in modern parlance?
That's harder to do than one might expect. Tantra is one of these words like religion that's hard to just give it an easy definition that everyone would agree upon. And it's also a complicated word in that it's, while the word itself, of course, is an indigenous word that goes all the way back to early in Indian history, the way that it's used today as a sort of a category, a type of Indian religiosity is really not how it was ever used by Hindus themselves or Indians themselves. So it's a sort of, the way we talk about it is a constructed academic category. But I think people in North America, for the most part, would tend, when they hear the word tantra, probably think of something like spiritual sex. That's a very common association. And oddly enough, in India, there are, while there are some sexual connotations to the word, it's more often linked with black magic, as I said before. So neither of those are, they're both kind of racy, not necessarily good connotations on either side, depending on your positioning. But historically, there's been all this fascinating work that's been done by this group of tantric studies scholars just in the past couple decades, led by Alexi Sanderson at Oxford, and then also many of his students. There's others as well, but he's sort of been leading the charge, and his students have been leading the charge, and really doing this intense, thorough, textual research that's been improving our knowledge of the tantric traditions. And we see that these kind of associations that are modern, both in India, tantra is black magic, and in North America and Europe, tantra is largely spiritual sex. Neither of them are a very good fit for what tantra was historically. So I have a chapter in my book. That's not the central point of my book by any means, but I do have a key lengthy chapter early in the book in which I try to say, okay, what was tantric, the tantric tradition historically? How is it not transgressive, as many scholars have said that tantra is fundamentally transgressive about breaking the rules of orthodoxy, breaking social codes of various times, especially in matters related to sexuality and sexual fluids and codes surrounding death. And that dimension is certainly present. It's not just made up, but that there is also a sort of mainstream tantric tradition that was very important, particularly in the medieval period. So trying to chart out exactly what that tantra looks like, it's a tradition that in which ritual is really at the heart of the tradition. ritual techniques that are specifically tantric. And the reason what makes them specifically tantric is these ritual techniques are laid out in texts that we can call tantras. Some of the texts are called tantras, others are called samhitas, others are called agamas, but it's common to just term all of these tantric texts tantras. And so as an academic category, I think what gives it coherence is to say that these ritual techniques are all found in this body of scripture called tantras. And what's unique about this body of scripture, of scriptures, is that it claims to be a revelation given straight from the gods that includes but actually transcends the Vedas, which you can imagine was very challenging to traditional kind of Brahminical sentiments where the Vedas were it. So these ritual techniques, there was something new about them in that the use of mantras was at the heart of tantric practice. So while the term tantra wasn't really used as a or a sort of genre of religiosity at that time, there was a term that translates essentially as the path of mantras, the mantra marga. And this was almost a synonym for the tantric traditions. And it shows how central the use of mantras was to this kind of ritual tantric religiosity I'm talking about. And here a mantra is a sort of the sonic equivalent of a god. It's a specific tantric understanding of a mantra. And these are mantras basically serve these sounds, sound forms of deities were what made the rituals effective. And what was also unique about this tantric practice is unlike some previous forms of popular Indian religiosity, there was sort of, it's a largely, the tantric universe is kind of amoral. It's a power, it's the divine is power that infuses the universe, and these tantric ritual techniques can help human practitioners access that power and employ that power. And that can be done for sort of spiritual purposes in order to become saved, liberated. But it can also be used for pragmatic worldly purposes to heal sickness, to defeat enemies, to bring rain in times of drought, any of these kind of things you might utilize a tantric ritual for. So there's as quick as I can get to kind of give you a sense of tantra, to get a better sense of how it becomes black magic in India and spiritual sex in America and Europe. The work of Hugh Urban is especially good for that. And that's a little bit out of the scope of my particular book.
I think that was a great summation of a fundamentally undefinable term like tantra. At very least, it demarcates the Indian taboos as well as the modern appropriations of the term, and gives us a bit of a sense of it being a bona fide religious path that is geared towards the generation of power, primarily through mantric means, for remediation, for worldly aims, for liberation. One quick question I have for you in terms of talking about deriving power, amoral power. Would you say necessarily that tantra in this context is related to the Devi, to the goddess, who is personified power?
It depends, I guess, how we would conceive the goddess. So tantra is a tradition that I would say transcends sort of religious boundaries as we typically understand them. So there was Hindu tantra, Buddhist tantra, Jain tantra. And even at this period of time in this medieval period, most scholars, I think at this point would agree that, even to say Hindu tantra is a bit anachronistic because you have Vaishnava tantra, Shaiva tantra, you don't have a sort of united Hindu front. And really most of these developments are happening, most importantly, in the sphere of Shaivism. So that is religion in which Shiva is the primary, the most powerful deity. But closely connected to the rise of Shaivism was the the rise of Shaktism, right? The rise of forms of religiosity in which the goddess Devi is central. And it seems to be the case that, a lot of this still needs further scholarly exploration, but that many of these goddess traditions may have been sort of brought into the Brahminical fold, into the Sanskritic fold, through being incorporated into Shaivism. So many of these goddesses were seen as the powers of Shiva. So in that way, Shaktism and Shaivism were really key dimensions of Tantra that kind of grew up together. But that being said, there are sort of Buddhist notions of power that in Tantric forms of Buddhism that parallel the sort of Hindu notion of Shakti, which would be sort of the power of the goddess, a cosmic power, which is what Tantricas tap into, that is always, gendered feminine, but that I think you could say exist across traditions. While that word wouldn't be used, Shakti, in, say, a Buddhist tradition, a similar concept would be there. So I think how explicitly it's connected to Devi, the goddess, would vary from tradition to tradition, but a sort of femininely gendered cosmic power, I think, is at the heart of Tantric traditions in general.
I think in your short time, you've probably elucidated for our listeners Tantra probably better than they'll come across in terms of how we understand Tantra in our culture. So thank you. Now, maybe tell us more to the heart of your book on the genealogy of bhakti, of devotion. You can approach it however you wish. You could either tell us how Tantric practices relate to the argument you're making, or you can start by saying, what is the essential argument you're making, whichever you prefer.
I mean, really, I view this book as it's most fundamentally about bhakti, hence the title, A Genealogy of Devotion, hence bhakti, again, a sort of a term we loosely translate as devotion, Hindu devotion. That's really the star of this narrative I'm telling, but I see Tantra, yoga, Sufism, and asceticism as kind of key co-stars in the story. And part of one of the basic moves I'm making is to say that bhakti, when you just call it devotion, first and foremost, and there's been a lot of work done on this already, that there's a tendency to have sort of Protestant Christian associations for what is meant by devotion. Many scholars of bhakti have countered this by saying, well, look at the etymology of bhakti. The etymology comes from a Sanskrit root. The word comes from a Sanskrit root, bhaj, which has to do especially with sharing and with participation. So scholars have taken this as sort of a jumping off point to point out how, in contrast to certain Protestant Christian assumptions about what devotion is, there's often a sort of active engagement, a sort of social dimension that involves a sharing with other bhaktas, other devotees, but also a sharing with God that is active. It takes real agency and it's very embodied. These have been kind of key points of a number of scholarly interventions in this field by some of the key scholars being Christian Novetsky, Jack Hawley, once again, Barbara Holdridge, Karen Pichilis, there are others, but they've been especially important in kind of making some of the points that I was just making. But I think what remained, even after that work, what hadn't really been done, as far as I could tell, was to show how intertwined bhakti historically has been, this what we just call devotion, with things that we tend to call yogic or tantric or ascetic. We scholars obviously need terms and categories to make sense of the stuff we study, but the world is a lot messier than that in practice. And once you keep using a category like asceticism in contrast to bhakti or tantra or yoga or Sufism, you start to, just by nature of the separate words and separate categories, it's easy to think of them as actual things that really are completely autonomous self-existing things. And that's, of course, not how the world or history or cultures actually work. So part of the project was to show, to sort of not try to give Bhakti search for some definition that's going to be always accurate. There is no such thing. The key concepts in any given culture, the meanings shift based on the specific context the word is being used in. So my thought was that Bhakti, historically, it changed the meaning of the concept of the term changes depending on the historical period it's being used in, the region that it's being used in. But more even than that, the meaning of the concept of Bhakti, of devotion, changes depending on its relationship to other key terms, other key concepts, other key modes of religiosity. So the ones that I thought were particularly interesting and hadn't been focused on were asceticism, yoga, and tantra. How does Bhakti's relationship with these sort of other modes, key concepts in Hindu religiosity kind of help to define what Bhakti is at different points in its historical development? And then when you get to a certain point, you have to also add in Islam, or more specifically Sufism, to that picture. And what is Bhakti's relationship with Sufism, and that, you know, how that relationship forms is key to understanding what Bhakti is. So that was one of the sort of interventions I wanted to make.
So that's all fascinating. Let's hold off for a second on Sufism, and let's maybe drill down into two of these three supporting characters. So we talked about this work being about the journey or the nature of devotionalism and Bhakti. We talk about Bhakti's interactions with these supporting characters or these other traditions, practices, Tantra, Yoga, Asceticism. We've talked about Tantra. Tell us about Yoga, Asceticism, maybe a brief definition. How are you using them? How are they the same, or how are they different? And about their overlap with devotionalism.
Right. Okay. A tough one to answer quickly, but I'll start with yoga. I mean, yoga is one of the hardest words to define. Quickly, again, a word that has very contextually specific meanings. But the way that I'm concerned with it in the book is primarily as a sort of assortment of methods of meditation and mind and body asceticism, sort of techniques for harnessing oneself. So if yoga, the etymology of the word yoga, it comes from a root yuj, one of the key meanings of which is to harness. So I think there's almost always some sort of harnessing going on with yoga, some sort of discipline, but more specifically a harnessing type of discipline happening, almost any form of yoga. But I'm particularly interested in methods of meditation and techniques of mind and body that are meant to either bring about spiritual realization or extraordinary power. That's sort of the definition of yoga I was using, as opposed to sort of more broad definitions of yoga just as a spiritual discipline or as union of some kind. On the topic of asceticism, again, this is just one of these huge conceptual words. And here, I mean it more in its kind of narrow sense, where you're typically talking about going against the grain of the body's typical animal instincts, right? The body wants food, it wants sleep, it wants sex. Asceticism typically goes against the grain of these biological instincts and desires, but with some sort of spiritual purpose in mind, some goal in mind. Maybe you, through acts of asceticism, often the kind of easy translation, or the term, multiple terms could be used, but the Sanskrit term I focus on is tapas, which can be boiled down to really translated into the word heat. And asceticism is the sort of physical practices that go against the grain of biological instincts and desires, and thereby produce a heat that is empowering to the ascetic. And that might mean kind of getting superpowers, but it also, you know, is connected to a sort of lifestyle often that might involve a certain amount of renunciation from normal social life. And in connection with all that, in the Indian context, traditionally, ascetics of various types have been given a special authority. So not a sort of superpower type of power, but just been highly respected and revered for taking up the difficult path that they have, in whether they're searching for liberation or more in search of powers. There traditionally have been a source of awe and reverence and even fear in India.
Now, asceticism, in terms of tapas, I often think of the word austerity. Mm-hmm. Obviously, tapas is literally heat, as you say, but the word austerity comes to mind for tapas. Or given that, asceticism and bhakti, devotionalism, as you point out in your book, are often or have often historically been thought of as opposed in some way, or dichotomous or structural opposites. And your work really, really softens that binary. Would you agree?
For sure. And that's, again, kind of a point that I wanted to make. And it's, I'm not the first to say this. Timothy Dove, for example, has said some really interesting things about this sort of false dichotomy between asceticism and bhakti, but I try to draw that out even more with, the traditions that I'm looking at. You know, I focus on a community known as the Ramanandi, is a bhakti monastic community. And I sort of use them as a case study to make a larger point that even stretches into the medieval period, in the what I call the tantric age, you know, before bhakti was quite as dominant as it became. And there seems to be a sort of continuous presence of, even beyond asceticism, an organized asceticism that we can call monasticism. So ascetics organized into monastic orders that then have their own institutions. And throughout India's history, monastic institutions seem to have been incredibly sort of enmeshed with political power, and thus, and also with the economic sphere in terms of trade, and thus to have just been major players in sort of the overall social life of India throughout India's history. Now, the specific ascetic orders and monastic orders that are, you know, most influential, most powerful, change from period to period, and that those changes are very consequential. But at the same time that we can chart out those changes, which I try to do in the book to some extent, especially showing how sort of bhakti monastic orders rise to prominence, whereas, you know, tantric ones may have been dominant in a previous era. At the same time, it's very interesting to note that this sort of continuous important presence of monastic institutions in religious, political, and economic life in India.
So, and why don't you, we've talked about these supporting actors, if you will, of Tantra and yoga, asceticism more broadly. So maybe this is a good time to talk about Sufism and the influence of Islam in India.
Okay. For sure. Another sort of intervention I wanted to make was to really try to make clear the influence, or maybe influence isn't even the right word, the sort of key resonance with the Sufi Islamic tradition that North India's early modern bhakti tradition had, and also to point out just how huge of a sort of cultural and social shift occurred beginning with the Sultanate period in India. So, you know, for decades now, And for good reason, the big focus has been on the British colonial impact on India and, you know, how much that changed India's future, how Indians had to respond to the not just sort of material, physical forms of oppression, but also to the sort of ways of thinking, the specific categories that were that were put upon them by Orientalist scholars and the British colonizers themselves. So we're talking about epistemological shifts. And a lot of that work has been, you know, hugely important, but sometimes what gets lost is how incredibly impactful this sort of previous period in Indian history was, when you have essentially these Persianized Turks coming in from Iran and Central Asia and settling, conquering much of North and Central India and settling gradually over vast swaths of the Indian subcontinent, and how this this Persian culture, which is not to say, which is not the same thing at all as Islam, but Islam was a part of this broader Persianate culture, to have this this Persianate culture interact with a sort of with the Sanskritic tradition of Orthodox Hinduism, that brought about major changes to Indian society. And obviously, you know, good scholarship has been done on that as well, but I hadn't seen the narrative of bhakti, of devotionalism's development sort of put into that context. And so that was something that I wanted to do, and something that in, you know, present day India, where you have, you know, Hindu nationalist rhetoric of both very soft and subtle forms and other more explicit forms kind of widely present, the idea of explicitly connecting an Islamic, you know, mystical tradition and its literature and worldviews and attitudes and values to, you know, the proud tradition of Hindu bhakti, which is has often been nationalized in the Hindu, in the sort of bhakti movement narrative. There is some political import there, and I think it's even more of an important sort of point to draw out in today's political climate, if that makes sense.
It does make sense, and maybe you can say a little bit more about that in terms of maybe connect the dots more explicitly in terms of what your findings on the genealogy of devotion in India, how they bear on many modern notions of Hinduism and Hindu nationalism even.
You know, that's not a topic I take up so explicitly in the book, but I'll try my best to speak to it. I mean, at least I don't explicitly get, I don't trace things so far into the modern period that I take up Hindu nationalism explicitly. But the larger argument of the book is certainly in conversation with other kind of narratives of Hinduism that would try to completely exclude Islamic influence, right? And I think, you know, it's fairly obvious that when you look at, when, as a historian, you look at, you know, the Sultanate period, which we say really begins around the beginning of the 13th century, again, with these Persianate Turks. And then you have, shortly following that, these Mongol invasions in Central Asia that cause tons of Persians, including some of the most important literati and just cultural elites, to all of a sudden migrate to Delhi. So sort of oddly, in the span of, you know, less than 50 years, you have India, where there's just, North India was a place where you had, you know, some, you would have raids from Muslim Afghans and Persian Iranian Muslims into North Indian cities, but no sort of extended presence. But then with the Sultanate, you have an extended attempt to build a Muslim civilization in India that is, initially a sort of out on its own. But then once you have this Mongol invasion, which happens right after the establishment of the Sultanate, suddenly Delhi becomes literally the center of Islam in the Eastern world. Delhi becomes a sort of, a place to come if you're a Islamic cultural elite. And so initially there's a sort of, the Islamic presence expands in urban centers as the Delhi Sultanate is expanding its power. But connected with that is the rise of Sufism. And so I don't think I fully answered your question before. It's Sufism, once again, one of these hard to define terms. There's no one kind of Sufi. There are all kinds of Sufis, warrior Sufis, orthodox Sufis, heterodox, mystical Sufis, Sufi literati, and sometimes those sort of types mixing together in any one individual Sufi. But to try to briefly characterize Sufism, it's typically understood as mystical Islam, and it's like Tantra, it is a tradition in which initiation is key. So the interesting thing about both Tantra and Sufism in that regard is that these are in some sense secretive, esoteric, initiatory traditions. They require initiation. Yet they both became became popular traditions. So how does that work? Well, these those who get initiated, and I'll go back to the Sufi context specifically now, kind of become seen as ideal Muslims. So they tend to have a mystical bent and an ascetic bent, but Sufis tended to be less about following the law and the letter of the Sharia than with an intimate devotional and mystical relationship with God based on love. And a Sufi sheikh, a sort of master Sufi, would have a host of disciples, but they would be sources of teachings for the greater Muslim populace, and not just Muslims, really. These became popular religious figures for Indians in general. They sort of cross religious boundaries. So the sites where these Sufi sheikhs would live, Indians would flock to them to, again, hear their sort of spiritual and ethical teachings, but also to perform certain rituals. There would be song and dance. There would be food for the poor at these Sufi retreats and Sufi hostels. And then when the Sufi was basically thought to have God's ear, have a special relationship and intimacy with God based on their level of spiritual achievement, and that popular devotees could sort of tap into that, could sort of seek healing or sort of pragmatic daily needs through the Sufi sheikh. And that's why they became such popular figures. And then it got to the point that when Sufis would die, their shrines became popular sites for devotion as well. And the Sufis' power seemed to only increase, the Sufi saints' power, that is, seemed to only increase after their death. So these very same things that devotees, the populace would want, they could ask the Sufi for, to ask God for, that is, at the shrine. So basically, as sort of Sultanate, Persianate, literary culture and political power is spreading across from North India outward, the same thing is happening with popular Sufism. And this is sort of the key context for understanding the development of North India's Bhakti movement, which really doesn't get off the ground until about the mid 15th century. And at that point, Persianate, Islamicate culture and popular Sufism are very well established in North and Central India. One of the points that I'm trying to make is that sometimes there's a narrative of a single Bhakti movement, the Bhakti movement that sort of starts in the Tamil South And then devotion kind of spreads like a wildfire from the south to the north up to India. And India's and it reaches North India last. And that Bhakti movement narrative is, you know, incredibly brilliantly treated in Jack Hawley's recent book, A Storm of Songs. So that's not really the key focus of my book, but it is relevant insofar as to say that, in fact, a single Bhakti movement sort of confuses the picture. Really, you have individual Bhakti movements happening within each region in the languages of those regions and according to the specific cultures of those, each of those regions. And one of my points is to say that North India's Bhakti movement, because of when it starts and where it is unique from other Bhakti movements and that happened earlier in regions south of North India. And that it is much more, as I say, Sufi inflected, much more influenced by the Persianate and Islamicate presence than the forms of Bhakti you see in other regional Bhakti movements.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
One of the reasons I personally quite enjoy this book, I mean, my duty is to help scholars like you get their work out in terms of Hindu studies in a way that the public can grapple with, the interest of the public. And so I don't really take sides in these arguments. I've had scholars come here making arguments that I firmly resonate with and that I firmly don't. And it's not my place to arbitrate that. But I will say in this moment that one of the ways in which this book resonates is that the narrative, at least the narrative when I first was introduced to the academic study of religion, which it would have been about 15 years ago, the narrative of bhakti starting in the south and just spreading like wildfire, it never entirely sat well. And this, and having said that, it wasn't my interest to pursue those kinds of questions. I pursue more literary questions and mythological questions. And so part of what deeply resonates is that your work really shows that bhakti flowers locally and regionally, and it's cross-pollinated by these other very, very rich rich entities like Sufism, yoga, tantra, etc., etc. So it's, in my view, deeply resonates. One thing that I think I'll ask you about your last section, because that may be one of the most surprising cross-pollinations, especially I think for people who are more familiar with the Hindu tradition or even practicing it, is this idea that devotionalism and tantra could be close dance partners. And so if I'm not mistaken, you set up your last chapter with this, what you call it? Your last section, yes, you call it Bhakti Religion and Tantric Magic. And although you've touched on this, I think it's a really important point to drill down on, of this sort of this idea of Bhakti being religion and Tantra being magic, mm-hmm. at very best. And could you say more about that, especially in terms of what you conclude in your book?
Okay, so bhakti religion and tantric magic, it's this dichotomy that I think it's not universal in contemporary India, but it is very common, as I think I mentioned earlier, to hear bhakti described as sort of good, wholesome religion. That's even if the word religion isn't used, that sort of sense is there, is that this is good, wholesome religion. Whereas tantra, again, not universally, but very commonly is associated with, again, black magic, things that are disreputable. There's suspicion surrounding it, or fear, or skepticism. It's got a certain dark cloud hang over it for many people. And I complicate this in the book by talking about how, in fact, tantra is very much integrated into modern India. But that doesn't sort of negate the fact that this discourse is there and very common, in which you have a sort of good bhakti religion and bad tantric magic. So the typical assumption has been that must be because of, colonial influence, Orientalist influence, right? You have these ideas of religion, magic are part of a Western Abrahamic sort of context. And so the British must have come in, these European scholars must have come in and sort of defined tantric modes of religiosity as, savage, irrational magic, we're actually seeing some similarities between Christianity and the devotion of Hinduism, and not exactly celebrating bhakti, but saying there's at least something valid here. Resembles religion. And, I quote some Orientalist scholars like Monier Williams, who make comments like this. And so it seems to be that there's this sort of open and shut case where clearly this perception of bhakti as kind of religion and tantra as magic must come from the colonial period. And part of what I'm trying to do in the book is to say that's kind of what happens sometimes with the sort of emphasis on colonialism and British and European influence, is it is easy to sort of miss historical continuities between pre-modern India and modern India. It's easy to attribute too much to the British. Clearly, colonial impact, European Orientalist impact was humongous. But in this particular case of how bhakti and tantra are perceived, one of the key points of my book is to draw out that you see these distinctions being made by the bhakti poets of early modern North India. I scoured the bhakti literature, hagiographies, poems, and songs of this period, and looking for references to yoga, tantra, and asceticism, and to yogis. And you often see the primary sort of representative of tantra in the early modern period was a group known as the Nath yogis. And you often see these Nath yogis, along with other tantric figures like Shaktas and other yogic figures and ascetics, you often see them sort of caricatured, but not just caricatured, sort of made into an other against which what I call a new bhakti sensibility and identity is forged. Identities always require an other, and often multiple others, to come into being, to form in opposition to. And I argue that a new bhakti identity, and more often than identity, I use the word sensibility, and I can talk about why that is, arises in this period, and that this bhakti sensibility is Sufi-inflected and tends to use the tantric yogi as its other. And I say this is interesting because it's new, because as I think I referenced earlier in our conversation, when you look to the medieval period and through most of India's history to this point, bhakti had been intertwined closely with tantra, yoga, and asceticism. So that's one of my early points, is that when you look at the history of bhakti, it's not this separate category from those things. It's totally intertwined with them. And in fact, in the medieval period, bhakti is most often, though you can find exceptions, but most often subordinated to tantric ritual and to jnana or knowledge. But by the time you get to early modern North India, bhakti starts to take on a different tone, and it starts to take on a more sort of exclusive understanding of itself, in which you don't need asceticism, you don't need yoga, and you certainly don't need tantra. So in caricaturing tantra through the tantric yogi in a particular way that highlights certain certain negative values and attitudes, a sort of lack of humility and a sort of arrogance and a self-assertiveness, over-enthusiasm for power, these sorts of things that match up remarkably well with Sufi sort of ethical and religious dispositions. You see these things emerging in the bhakti literature and in their critiques of tantric yogis. So sort of defining this new bhakti sensibility, which I say is a very Sufi inflected bhakti sensibility, largely against a caricatured version of tantra. And that caricatured version of tantra, again, they're not, these poets aren't, and saints aren't actually using the word magic, and rarely even a sort of Hindi translation of the word magic, but the way in which they sort of mock, demonize, subordinate aspects of tantric religiosity to bhakti matches up exactly with the way that the religion magic distinction has functioned historically. And sort of magic just becomes unauthorized religion. Magic substantively isn't actually anything different. It's just that form of religiosity that is not approved. And that approval might be because of political power reasons, but it might be because of moral and ethical reasons. That's how the word magic has functioned historically in, you know, in all kinds of contexts across cultures. But you see that sort of same rhetoric, a sort of religion versus magic discourse happening in the early modern period. And I think that that shows a kind of pre-colonial indigenous kind of origin for thinking about tantra in a particular way that's very caricatured. And bhakti in a particular way. And that I think the real influence for that is actually coming from, again, this sort of Persianate, Islamicate, Sufi presence. And all that's happening well before the British presence is anything significant. And I think probably affects the way that the British and that Orientalist scholars come to see bhakti and tantra, that they're actually affected by these pre-existing, you know, increasingly dominant bhakti views of bhakti and of tantra. Does that make sense?
That makes a whole lot of sense to me. It's really fascinating. If I can share just a tiny bit of data from the text that I work on that might be of interest to this conversation. So you may or may not know that I work on, or at least my last book was on the Devi Mahatmya, mm-hmm. right? The mythological accounts of the great goddess of Hindu India. The text in its current form, and it's a stable text, dates to perhaps around 5th century CE. And in the culmination of the text, the 13th chapter, the final chapter, is where it's the end of the frame narrative, where the glories of the goddess are told by a sage to a merchant and a king. The last chapter is where the merchant and the king, now having heard about the goddess's glories, they go off and they worship her. And the religiosity they exhibit, I think, would be fascinating for your purposes as well, in that they sit down by the banks of a river, they create a murti. To that murti, they offer incense, water, a very devotional paradigm. They sing praises to the goddess. They also fast. It says specifically they restrain their senses and they fast, and specifically that they offer blood of their own limbs. Mm-hmm. And the goddess magically appears before them, boons them in accordance with their desire. The king wants social power. He wants his kingship back. the merchant wants jnana. He wants insight into the absolute. He wants to be freed from the shackles of samsara, and she boons him with both. And so in this course of maybe 5 to 10 verses, in my view, you have dovetailed devotionalism, asceticism, tantra, jnana, really so much of what you're talking about. This is 5th century CE. I haven't heard a quibble from anybody within the Indic tradition or scholars of the Indic tradition. I haven't really heard a quibble in terms of aspects of this religiosity that were unacceptable in some way or that didn't fit. And yet you can appropriate this very rich religiosity for tantra, for bhakti, for a number of avenues. So I thought I'd share that thought with you.
No, that's fascinating. And I think kind of proves confirms the point I'm making, especially about medieval religiosity and how these kind of intertwined threads of Hindu religiosity that you just mentioned, bhakti, asceticism, tantra, yoga, and also the sort of pragmatic, this worldly stuff versus also the transcendent, all those things are completely intertwined. And you can sort of, as a scholar, try to parse them out, but it's very difficult to do. But what's sort of new that I think is happening in the early modern period in North India is those intertwined threads are starting to kind of come apart a little bit. And it's that there's some of these modes start to get distinguished from each other, these modes of religiosity and positioned against each other in ways that historically they hadn't been. And that's not to say that they were completely merged in the past, but it's to say that I don't think there's much evidence that a bhakta is ever positioned directly in opposition to a tantrika or a yogi in much medieval literature, but you start to see that happening, exactly that, in the early modern North Indian bhakti literature. And I do think that part of that change is the specific kind of cultural context and Sufi influence, which has a very kind of clear ethical and aesthetic and emotional kind of outlook that just doesn't really fit with the way tantra historically operated.
It seems to me that the Devi Mahatmya would agree with you. So one final question, since we've taken enough of your time for today, and I know you have to go soon. So what are you working on now? What are you researching? What are you writing?
Well, I would say two separate kind of projects. One really key figure in my book that we didn't get a chance to talk about is a Vaishnava, Ramanandi, bhakti poet and saint by the name of Agradas. And there's a chapter just on Agradas because he's little known and very important. And studying his literature allows me in the book to really say a lot about how these bhakti communities, how they articulated their own identity, how they sought patronage, how they spread and became bigger. So he's a key figure in the book. And in the research for the book, I was able to get a lot of manuscripts of his material. And I did not exhaustively treat that in the book by any means. So one project is to further delve into the literature of this bhakti poet, Saint Agradas, and try to do some translations and interpretation analysis of that. But I'm also drawn increasingly away from the world of the Mughal period and bhakti that has been my bread and butter. And actually I'm interested in a new project that would take me into the colonial period and into modern India. And that project would center on the sort of modern categories of magic, science, and religion. And they would basically be about the rise of modernity as a process that is happening in India and in dialogue with the India and the West. And particularly, I would be looking at how these categories of magic and science and religion are crucial to the rise of modernity itself, both in the West and in India. And since that topic is so broad, the whole the key to this project was I'd be doing this through a study of yoga and yogis. And what's fascinating is that depending on where you stand, you can easily make a case that yoga is magical, yoga is scientific, yoga is religious, or perhaps some mix of any of those three. And the same thing with yogis. So I think in looking at how yoga and yogis during both by Indians and by Westerners, how they were talked about, how they were represented, I think it will provide a fascinating case study for how these bigger concepts and categories, magic, science, and religion, sort of were the key building blocks for notions of modernity itself, even if those played out a little bit differently, ultimately in India and in the West.
That sounds absolutely fascinating. And I will look forward to inviting you back on the podcast when that work comes out, because it's certainly one we should chat about. So once again, we have been talking with Patney Burchett, Assistant Professor at the Department of Religious Studies at the College of William & Mary. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran, with the Hindu Studies channel of the New Books Network. Patton, it's been great having you on the program.
Thank you again for inviting me to be here.
Until next time, keep reading. Take care.